As we continue with Jephthah's story, we now come to Jephthah's vow. Judges chapter 11, verse 30 and 31. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." This vow is what has made Jephthah famous and controversial over the centuries. Bible scholars are divided in their views about this. Some believe the vow was carried out literally, and others believe it was carried out in a way that did not require the daughter's death. I lean toward the latter view. Jephthah makes a vow about whatever or whoever, the Hebrew pronoun can be either, is the first to come out of the doors of my house to meet me when he returns in victory. Animals were not kept in the house in those days, certainly not sacrificial animals, so he's not referring to an animal. Besides, he specifically says, to meet me, which would not be true of an animal anyway. Therefore, he is most likely expecting a household servant to come out and meet him. His vow was not to make a literal burnt sacrifice for four reasons. First, the previous verse, verse 29, states that God's Spirit came upon him. The Spirit would not move him to make a vow involving human sacrifice, something God abhorred. Secondly, like every Israelite, Jephthah knew very well that a sinful human being could never be a suitable sacrifice to Jehovah God. Thirdly, Jephthah is named in Hebrews chapter 11 as a man of faith, one of the heroes of faith, in fact. How does he get included in that listing if he actually did such a horrible thing as making a human sacrifice? And fourthly, the sequel to the story does not specifically state that anyone died in carrying out the vow. It is helpful to note that the Hebrew word for burnt offering also refers to the kind of sacrifice which shows the total surrender of the heart and life of the offerer to God. So Paul makes use of this idea in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. "I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice." The word for sacrifice here is specifically one associated with burning with fire, but that is obviously not what Paul intended literally. Therefore, Jephthah's plan seems to me to be to dedicate to God's permanent service the first person who comes out to meet him after his return from battle. In Old Testament Israel, people served God in this way at the tabernacle. Even women were sometimes dedicated for this kind of tabernacle service. After the battle, as Jephthah returns to his home, his daughter is the first one out the door to greet him. His joy from the victory turns quickly to anguish. Chapter 11 again, verse 34 and 35. "When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, 'Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot go back on it.'" Perhaps the reason for his anguish is not because he must kill her, but because he had hoped apparently to begin a ruling dynasty within his family, under God's blessing. Remember, his initial concern was about what? Being the head, the ruler, the chief over the Gilead tribes. As he sees his daughter coming out to meet him, he realizes that this hope of a ruling dynasty is no longer possible, because she must be dedicated to God's permanent service and therefore never marry. Verse 34 makes it abundantly clear that the main issue has to do with children and the ongoing future of his family, by telling us twice, "She was his only child, besides her he had neither son nor daughter." To fulfill his vow, she must serve God at the tabernacle and never marry. It is the fact that she will never marry and have children that creates deep sorrow for the daughter as well as the father. Consequently, she asks for 2 months before having the vow fulfilled, so that she can weep with her friends over the fact that she will be unable to marry. Verses 37 and 38 repeat this emphasis. And verse 39 indicates the result of the vow. That she was burned up on an altar of sacrifice? No. That she remained a virgin. This interpretation is not the most common one, and many commentators still take the view that Jephthah's daughter was killed in fulfillment of his vow. And when you read the final verse in chapter 11, it looks like perhaps that would indeed be the best reason for Israelite girls to commemorate or lament Jephthah's daughter for 4 days every year. But even here, a closer look at the verb is valuable. This word commemorate or lament is only used in one other place in the whole Bible. Judges chapter 5, verse 11. In Deborah's song, she says that singers recite the righteous acts of the Lord. That helps us to recognize what this annual commemoration was all about. It wasn't a sad time of lamenting the death of Jephthah's daughter. It was a time to recite or rehearse her deeds, to remember her obedience in helping her father fulfill his solemn vow to the Lord. Let's note three valuable lessons here. First of all, keeping our promises, especially to God, is very important. Maybe Jephthah should not have made this vow to God. That's certainly debatable. But having made it, he treated it as absolutely unchangeable. Verse 35, I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot go back on it. Even when it hurts, as it did for both Jephthah and his daughter, they kept this vow. Psalm 15, verse 4 tells us that one of the qualities required for someone who wants to live with God is that he keeps his oath or promise even when it hurts. Paul Little once told about a young lady he knew who signed a contract to teach at a certain school. The month before the school year was to start, she received an offer from another school closer to where she wanted to live. So she broke the first contract and signed with the other school. The department chairman at the first school said her justification was, I have a peace about it. And he commented rather sardonically, isn't that lovely? She's got the peace, and I've got the pieces. As Christians who have a covenant relationship with the living God, we must be people of integrity, whose word can be trusted, who keep their promises. James Jordan suggests that the outcome of this strange story is that God frustrates Jephthah's dynastic desires, and instead of God building Jephthah's house, as this judge had hoped would be his reward for the vow, Jephthah builds God's house by giving up his only child to serve at the tabernacle. Maybe a reminder to Israel from God about whose house should be built. Secondly, don't make unnecessary promises or vows in the hope that these will encourage God to do something or give you something you want. Jephthah simply didn't need to make this vow at all. God could bear Israel's misery no longer, the Bible tells us. He brought Jephthah to his leadership position, and he empowered him to fight the enemy of God's people. God didn't require Jephthah to add any promises to what God was already doing. This was something Jephthah came up with himself, as a way of twisting God's arm. He said, if you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be. We must beware of any attempts to manipulate God into acting for our benefit. That's exactly what characterized Israel's worship of false gods and idols. Our walk of faith must be one of obedience to a God who is sovereign. Thirdly, Jephthah's vow is also a reminder to us about our priorities. Larry Crabb highlighted this issue in a blunt statement. He said, whenever we place a higher priority on solving our problems than on pursuing God, we are immoral. When we put our own selfish interests and personal dreams ahead of God, we are indeed immoral. And just as he did with Jephthah, God may frustrate our desires too, causing us to remember, perhaps too late, that the wise way to live is putting God first, a truth expressed by Jesus himself as the first and most important commandment. Mark 12, verse 30, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. Now let's take a look at Jephthah and the Ephraimites. Judges chapter 12, beginning with verse 1. Then the men of Ephraim gathered together, crossed over toward Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you with fire. And Jephthah said to them, my people and I were in a great struggle with the people of Ammon, and when I called you, you did not deliver me out of their hands. So when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? Now Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, you Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. The Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim who escaped said, let me cross over, The men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" If he said no, then they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. Then they would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. There fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. And Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried among the cities of Gilead. In this odd epilogue to Jephthah's story, 42,000 Ephraimites die because of a pronunciation problem. But that, of course, was not the real reason. Evidently, the overall national situation, especially spiritually, has deteriorated further by this time. Have we seen this scenario of Ephraimites complaining before? Yes, in chapter 8, when Gideon was judge. But the selfishness of this tribe has now gotten worse. The Ephraimites really heat up the problem with their insults and anger. Ephraim complained here to Jephthah in a very similar way as they had done with Gideon. It seems they were always brave after the battle. They are pictured as an arrogant, critical, envious little tribe. According to fishermen, you never need a cover on a basket of crabs. If one starts to climb up the sides, the other crabs will all reach up and pull that one back to the bottom again, just like Ephraimites. Jephthah claimed he had asked them to help fight, but they did not come. They were unwilling to accept their responsibilities. They were much better at criticizing their brothers than fighting the enemy. Much later, this same tribe opposed David as king of Israel, and then later they rebelled against Solomon and broke away under Rehoboam. They were constantly proud and envious, and their destruction is deserved. Jephthah fought Ephraim, then captured the fords of Jordan, identified Ephraimites trying to cross back over by giving them that pronunciation quiz, and killed 42,000 of them. Joshua chapter 1 verse 18 and Deuteronomy 37:12 state that rebels against the judge must be put to death. So Jephthah is carrying out this severe requirement according to God's law. However, there is an element of God's heavy humor evident here. In Gideon's story, it was the Ephraimites who secured the fords of the river so the Midianites could be captured. Now, Jephthah secures the river fords against the Ephraimites themselves, whom God now called fugitives in verse 5, after they themselves had accused the Gileadites of being fugitives in verse 4. This incident decimated the tribe of Ephraim, who had been the most powerful up till then. They were too strong to accept a king from any other tribe, but they never regained prominence, and it is significant that the first kings in Israel's monarchy did not come from this tribe. Their example here is a strong caution against developing any similar arrogant, critical attitude, especially in relation to fellow believers in the family of God. In our next session, we will encounter one of the most famous characters in the Bible, Samson. Don't miss it.